It's actually the longest Creusot Tara of the year compared together. Plus, there was Precious Carter that had a little bit as well. And I just wanted to go over some basic ideas about the Mishkan. That during these first years of Mishkan, I was away for part of the time, so we actually haven't gone over them. And that is, there's a very, very interesting machlokas Rashi in the Ramban, how to understand the Mishkan. If you look at the Torah, in Parshas Truma and Parshas Tetzaveh, which is before the Chedor Ego, that is when Hashem gave Moshe the command to build the Mishkan. Then we have Chedor Ego, Moshe Rabbeinu praying, and Moshe Rabbeinu going up to Har Sinai. And Moshe Rabbeinu comes down with the second Luchas, like the second tablets, because he broke the first tablets. He comes down with the second Luchas the day after Yom Kippur, on Yom Kippur itself. Now, as I said, I think I mentioned this, there's kind of a catch-22 or a chicken and egg problem. We are not sure, there are different ways of describing it. Is it the pshat that Hashem forgave the Jewish people on that day because it was Yom Kippur? Or did it become Yom Kippur because Hashem forgave us? Meaning it was the forgiveness of the Chedor Ego that made Yom Kippur, Yom Kippur. Okay, but be it as it may, Moshe Rabbeinu comes down on Yom Kippur with the second Luchas. And the day after Yom Kippur, he gathers people together and he tells them to start donating towards the building of the Mishkan. So again, if you look at the sequence of the Torah, Hashem commanded Moshe about the Mishkan before the Chedor Ego, which means in the 40 days that Moshe was in Har Sinai. But Moshe did not tell Bnei Israel about that commandment until after the forgiveness of the Chedor Ego, because Moshe was busy with keeping the Jewish people alive, so to speak. And therefore, that was after the Yom Kippur. So how long? So Jews were contributing towards the making of the Mishkan from the day after Yom Kippur. So till when? So let me just give you a little of the chronology to be sure that you understand. The Mishkan was undergoing construction, different parts of it, until the 23rd of Adar. Meaning, actually that was Shabbos. By the 23rd of Adar, all of the components of the Mishkan were completed. And that is 1 week before Nisan. So for the next week, every single day, it's a pretty daunting task, every single day, Moshe Rabbeinu would put up the Mishkan and then take it down at the end of the day. Up, down, up, down, up, down. And for those 7 days, Moshe Rabbeinu was the officiating Kohen, not Aaron. And these 7 days are called the 7 days of Miluim, Shivas Yimei HaMiluim, which means the 7 days of preparatory consecration. And they ran from the 23rd of Adar until Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And what are the characteristics of those 7 days of Miluim? During those 7 days of Miluim, Moshe Rabbeinu put up the Mishkan every day and took it down every night. Moshe Rabbeinu did the Avodah of all of the Korbanos. And special Korbanos were brought by Moshe. Moshe did it in order to prepare Aaron and his children to be the Kohanim. And then there were special rules that for those 7 days of Miluim, Aaron and his children were not allowed to leave the courtyard of the Mishkan, because essentially they were getting ready, just like a person, before you're an astronaut or something, you have to be segregated from everybody to get ready for this awesome responsibility. Now this is called the Shivas Yimei HaMiluim. After the 7 days of Miluim, the Mishkan was finally ready to be permanently set up, although it was never permanent, it was moved, but without taking it down every night, on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Rosh Chodesh Nisan was the dedication of the Mishkan, and that was the day in which the 12 Nisians began bringing their korbanos. You'll recall in the Book of Amidbar, the Nisim brought korbanos, and each Nasi brought the identical korban. That started Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So people get confused sometimes. Do not confuse the 7 days of Miluim with the 12 days of dedication offerings. The 12 days of Chanukah Sabayis, they begin from Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and they go through the 12th of Nisan, and that includes the Shabbos in between, that the Korbanos of the Nisim were brought even on Shabbos. On that day of Rosh Chodesh Nisan, when the Mishkan was dedicated, that happens to also be the day that Aaron's two oldest children died, that very same day, Nadav and Avihu, because they brought incense by using a fire that they brought into the Mishkan instead of using the fire of the altar that came down from heaven. So on that very, very, otherwise very joyous, happy day of the dedication of the Mishkan, that was the very day that Nadav and Avihu died. Okay, now this is the chronology that the Torah gives us. However, there's a very interesting medrash that says that although the Mishkan was not consecrated until Rosh Chodesh Nisan, in fact, it was ready to be consecrated in the month of Kislev, on the 25th day of Kislev. Now, that's several months before. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to delay the consecration of the dedication of the Mishkan until the month of Nisan, which is the month of redemption. And therefore, he had to promise, he had to make it up to Kislev by saying, hey, you know, you're losing out the dedication opportunity. And that is why many, many centuries later, the day of Hanukkah was chosen to be the day that the Jews were able to dedicate the second temple. Because that was compensation for Hanukkah, or for the day that later became Hanukkah, missing out on the 25th of Kislev. Okay. So, it's interesting, you know, in Israel, I don't know if anyone here is an Israeli citizen, but you know, Tuesday is a big election. So we have a religious community where one half of the community says to vote for certain candidates, and the other half says you're not allowed to vote at all. So side by side, if you walk in Meir Shearim, you see signs that say, vote for Gimel, you know, vote for Gimel. Gimel is the Torah party. And other signs say it is forbidden to vote in these corrupt elections. So you can't stop it. If you hear some car go by, you know, you have to listen. Sometimes it's telling you not to vote, so it's telling you to vote. So you have to know what you're listening to.
But which one was that?
That was to vote, yeah. Okay. And of course, here in Arsimea, we ordered you, you know, if anyone here is a real citizen, there's a sign up who you must vote for. They're told, you know, go to vote and vote for these candidates. But again, the Gedolim said that indeed this is what we should do. Okay. Anyway, so this is the basic chronology. Now, all of this is in the Chumash, but here is the big machlokas, Rashi and Ramban. It's a very, very big machlokas. Rashi quite amazingly says that the whole parshios of the Mishkan are not in chronological order. Rashi applies the rule that's in the Gemara. You've heard this rule. Ein muktam u'me'uchar b'Torah. Right? You've heard that klal. That klal means the Torah does not always give you events in chronological order. Now, what does that mean, Rashi says? Although Hashem commanding Moshe about the Mishkan appears before the Chet Ha'Egel, it is out of order. And in fact, Hashem did not command Moshe to build a Mishkan until after the Chet Ha'Egel. In other words, Rashi is telling you a very surprising thing. Had there not been a Chet Ha'Egel, there would not have been a Mishkan. The Mishkan existed, and I think that also means the Beis HaMikdash existed, only because of the Chet Ha'Egel. Now Rashi doesn't say why that's so. So let me tell you, there are three explanations why there would not have been a Mishkan except for the Chet Ha'Egel. and therefore the Mishkan is a response to the Chayei Egel. The first explanation is that of the Sephorno. Now the Sephorno is not explaining Rashi. The Sephorno happens to have the same view as Rashi, but gives an explanation. The Sephorno, right, you, that's one of the great Meforshim of the Rishonim. The Sephorno, however, is several centuries after Rashi. Rashi was in the 11th century, the 1000s, and the Sephorno is in the 16th century, the 1500s, Renaissance Italy. And this is one of the great Meforshim on Chumash. And the Sephorno says the following. The Sephorno says that the Mishkan is really a failure or a deficiency in our time. Because in the ideal world of righteousness, Hashem would be equally accessible everywhere. Every backyard could be the Beis HaMikdash. You wouldn't need a special place to bring korbanos. You also wouldn't need special people like Kohanim. Every person would be elevated enough, would be holy enough to bring korbanos. Meaning, remember, at Matan Torah, we reach the level of Adam HaRishon before the Chet. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah says we were immortal, we would not have died. The Chet HaEgel brought us back. The Chet HaEgel was a re-expulsion of Adam HaRishon from Gan Eden. So consequently, the Sephorno says, and this is what Rashi would mean as well, that the concept that God is reachable only in a certain place, only in a certain way, only by certain people, as wonderful as it is that we have that opportunity, that's a wonderful thing, but that represents a spiritual failure, that represents a chisaron, and therefore Rashi is learning, hypothetically, had there not been a chet ha'egel, there would not have been a Mishkan at all. Because everybody would be a Kohen. Every place would be a Mishkan. You don't need a special place. Now, this Bichlal raises a very, very interesting philosophical question. And that is, but you know, this is not the only place where this question comes up. You know, we say the Torah pre-existed the creation of the world. The Torah existed before there was a world, and in fact the Torah was the blueprint from which Hashem made this world. As the Svarim say, it's not that since we have parents, God gave us a mitzvah of kibud av v'aim. It's the other way around. Since the Torah says you have to honor your parents, so God had to make parents, otherwise you didn't have to have parents. Right? It's the Torah that dictated the reality, instead of the reality dictating the Torah. So it's a very fascinating problem. It's a conundrum. Because on one hand, everybody has free will. Now, which means we had the free will not to commit the sin of the golden calf. But if we wouldn't have committed the sin of the golden calf, how could the Torah pre-exist and talk about the golden calf? And how could the Torah talk about the Mishkan if there was a theoretical possibility that we wouldn't have sinned and we wouldn't have had the Mishkan? So what would have happened to all of those verses which pre-existed the existence of the world? Would God have to rewrite the Torah? But that contradicts the idea that the Torah pre-existed the universe. It is a difficulty. Of course, part of the answer is God knows the future, so therefore God takes everything into account. But one explanation that's given is, it's similar to the Bible codes, that the Torah exists on many levels. The breaking down of the words and the sentences that says, you committed the golden calf, just would have assumed a different form. It would have been God's unbroken divine names, but it wouldn't have expressed those words and the like. But it is a difficulty. In other words, it is a difficulty. In fact, but it's not just that. I mean, every sin that's part of the Torah is going to be a problem. The sin of Adam HaRishon, they had free will. The sin of Korach, the sin of the Meraglim. But all of this, you're saying, was already recorded in the Torah before it happened. And yet, at the time, everybody had free will. Right? That's going to be a fundamental problem. But this is just one example of that problem. Okay. So that's the Sephorno. So again, the Sephorno's understanding is that if there wouldn't have been a Chet HaEgel, Hashem would have been accessible from every place and by every person. And therefore, the Mishkan is a monument to our failure that we were no longer deserving of that type of connection. That's the Saporna. Explanation number two for Rashi is offered by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari. Now, again, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is not explaining Rashi. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was even earlier than Rashi. But are you familiar that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was both one of our Gedolim, but was also a very great poet, a very great philosopher. And he wrote one of the great books of Jewish philosophy, although actually he's anti-philosophy, because he's an anti-philosophy philosophy book. Yes, it's really very different than the Rambam, who was a very pro-philosophy. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote the Kuzari. If you recall, just a little bit of information, if you recall, he adopted a literary structure for the Kuzari, meaning it was based on historical fact, but he made up the book to express his ideas. That is, there was a warring tribe in Russia. This goes back to the 900s, a real long time ago, that were the Khazars. And the Khazars actually converted to Judaism. In fact, there's an old discredited theory that virtually all Ashkenazic Jews are actually descended from the Khazars. We're not, Ashkenazim are not the original Jews. They all come from the converts of the Khazars. Okay, that's all interesting. Because that actually explains a very interesting problem. Because the problem basically is that how come Ashkenazic Jews tend to be light complexioned and the like? That wasn't the Middle Eastern look of the Jews. Sephardim would be more like the Middle Eastern Jew. So some have suggested that the core of Ashkenazic Jews actually come from the Khazars. But be as it may. So it was well known in Yehuda Levi's time that this group of Khazars had converted to Judaism. And there was a story because that this was based on the fact that the king of the Khazars had a dream. And he was told by God, or by an angel of God, your kavanos are very good, but your deeds are not good. And that made the king want to try to investigate what is the best way to serve God. And the story goes, he talked to different people, and finally he was convinced that Judaism was the right way, and he converted his whole people. Everybody converted based on the king. Right? This was a true story. So Yehuda Halevi took that story, and he reconstructed. Now again, there's a little bit of a fake thing in the Kuzari, because Rabbi Halevi claims he found a long-lost manuscript, everyone knows that was made up. But basically, the actual dialogue, meaning he has the king having the dream, and the king calls in a Muslim and a Christian and a Greek philosopher and a Jewish rabbi. Sounds like one of those jokes, you know. And they start having discussions. And the Kuzari is the record of the discussions primarily between the king and the rabbi. So all the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi writes as a literary conceit that this was a manuscript that he had found. In fact, he claims he didn't write the Kuzari. He says the Kuzari is really a manuscript of this rabbi, etc. But essentially, he used the story as just a device to convey his ideas. So the Kuzari is considered to be one of the very, very important svarim on the Jewish philosophy. Yeah.
Did he say it was a manuscript?
He says it, but he was a poet, so on that level he was taking a little poetic lessons. He mentions that he had found, but it was part of the story. I mean, I think from the time the Kuzari was published, nobody ever believed that he had found some long lost manuscript.
So he wasn't blatantly lying.
Well, it's type of a thing, when you write a story, so people understand it was the nature of a story. But the core of it, that the Khazars converted because of a dream the king had, that is true, and he used that as the basis of his philosophy, and that is why you have to know when you read the Kuzari, and the king, the non-Jewish king, is asking questions. Those are also Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's questions. That the Nagai, so he's speaking from the side of both characters. So anyway. In the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi adopts the same shita. Oh, by the way, you know the story how Rabbi Yehuda Halevi died. Now, they say this is not true either. But it's an old legend. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lived in Spain. And he had a tremendous, tremendous love for Eretz Yisrael. In fact, some of the Kinos on Tisha B'Av were written by him about the yearning for Tziyah, the yearning for Yerushalayim, the fact that he desires to walk the dirt of Eretz Yisrael, even though it was poor and he would suffer, but just to be there rather than the wealth of the nations of the world. So the legend has it that he finally came to Eretz Yisrael towards the very, well, since you see, towards the very, very end of his life. And after a long, arduous, and dangerous voyage by land and by sea, he came to the land of Israel, and he is finally coming up to the gates of Yerushalayim, the walls of the old city, because those walls were built by Muslims. They're not the Jewish walls of the old city. And right as he's about to prostrate himself, he's about to bow down to Hashem. In gratitude, the story goes, an Arab horseman drove by and pierced him with a spear. And the story goes, Yehuda HaLevi died at the gates of Yerushalayim without ever entering the city. This was an old tradition, but again, some historians say that that's not true either. But nevertheless, this is a story that's repeated very often. Okay, but anyway, what did Yehuda HaLevi say about the Chet HaEgel? So he says the following. He says, what was the Chet HaEgel? The sin of the golden calf. So he says, it couldn't have been that people thought that this calf that they had made with their own hands and their own jewelry was actually God. How could they believe it's God? They made it themselves. How could you believe what you made is God? Moreover, look at the pasuk. When they decided to make the egel, it says the following: "Kum asay lanu Elohim." We don't say Elohim because we're not talking about God. Let us make a god, small g, asher yelchu lefaneinu, that shall go in front of us. Ki zeh Moshe ha'ish, because Moshe the man, now that's even superfluous, the man who took us out of Mitzrayim, lo yadanu, we do not know, me haya lo, what happened to him. Right, Moshe's up in the mountain, he didn't come down yet, we think he's late. So it's very clear that the egel was not made to take the place of God. The egel was made to take the place of Moshe. And they didn't think Moshe was a god because it says Moshe the mortal, Moshe the man. And yet, the first part of the pasuk does say, let us make a god. So how do you understand that? So the Kuzari explains that the Jewish people did not know how to relate to a deity that was without body, without shape, without form, that had no physicality. They thought they were physical, they needed some physical representation. So they viewed Moshe Rabbeinu as a spiritual intermediary who could receive and channel divine energy in a way that they could not access themselves. In other words, the Jewish people felt, or at least some of the Jewish people felt, that they were so magushan, they were so material, they were so corporal, that they were not capable. Again, it's similar to an electrical transformer. When you have the 110 and the 220, what happens basically is that sometimes you have a very, very powerful current. And the powerful current is going to destroy the appliance unless you have a transformer that can cut it down. So too, they felt they were not able to receive spiritual energy from God. They would explode. They were not a vessel that could contain this holiness. So they needed someone like Moshe Rabbeinu, who had a huge capacity, who could receive the energy and then have it subdivided into units that people could absorb. Now, we don't even understand this idea that well, but essentially, this is called spiritual channeling, in which you have a tangible intermediary who receives divine force and can then distribute it in ways that people can receive. So, when Moshe is gone, they feel they have no way of relating to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So they created the egel. Now we don't understand how this works either, to be a spiritual intermediary and channeler. Apparently the belief was that even physical objects could kind of receive the energy and then cut it down and distribute it in the right ways. And the Ramban says the same thing. So it turns out that the chet ha'egel was not really a chet of avodah zarah, but it was a chet of ascribing powers to intermediary forces instead of praying and connecting to Hashem directly. And by the way, this is still a problem on Hayom Hazeh. It's a problem in the way some people connect to a Rebbe, which they look at a Rebbe as this intermediary force. It's a problem when people go to the graves of tzaddikim, in which sometimes people pray to the dead tzaddik, which is absolutely forbidden. One only prays to Hashem and asks Hashem to help them in the merit of the great tzaddik. But you don't pray to the tzaddik. Even in Shalom Aleichem, there were people who did not say the stanza of asking the angels to bless me, Borchuni l'shalom. All right, we're not so machmer in that, but some people say they will not. And in Slichos, there's a passage in the Slichos, before Rosh Hashanah, Machnisei Rachman, and we ask the angels to bring our prayers to God. Some people do not say that. Again, I'm in against, we do say those things, but some people are very, very machmer that all references to prayers have to be only to Hashem.
Why, according to some people, does it make a difference to pray at the grave of the tzaddik at all? It's not like he has no power at all over what's going to happen.
No, the tzaddik certainly has no power at all, but the idea of praying at the grave of the tzaddik is that when you're in proximity to the tzaddik, so some of his spiritual aura inspires you and lifts you, and you're actually asking Hashem that in the merit of the good deeds of the righteous, may Hashem answer our prayers. And that is true, because we do ask Hashem. In Shemona Esrei, we ask Hashem, give us salvation in the merit of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and even other tzaddikim. Later tzaddikim, you can do it as well. So one can pray to Hashem in the merit of the righteous, but one does not pray to the righteous.
Isn't there Tanaim, I don't know exactly who said that, if you come to my grave, like in such and such situation, that I will do what I can?
Well, yeah, but once again, that's kind of the idea, that when you pray to Hashem in the merit of the tzaddik, the tzaddik will also pray for you. But you don't pray to the tzaddik, right? The tzaddik will pray to Hashem as well. There was a person who once said, it's very extreme, somebody said, why do you pray to a Rebbe? You should pray to Hashem. Why don't you pray to Hashem? He says, I do pray to Hashem. I pray to Hashem that the Rebbe should answer me. Okay. A little bizarre. Okay. All right. Anyway, so you understand the Chet HaEgel. So the Chet HaEgel, according to the Kuzari, was the notion of needing to have a physical representation of the Creator in the form of a spiritual intermediary. That was the sin. That was a great sin. But it wasn't pure idolatry. They believed in Hashem, but they thought they needed this intermediary. So here is where the Kuzari says a fascinating point. The Kuzari says that when Klal Yisrael has a weakness within their personality that they can't really get over, Hashem will give them a compensation. Now the Gemara Nechulin says it by food. The Gemara Nechulin says every single food that Hashem says you can't eat, He gave you a kosher food that has a similar taste. Of course, today, with all these artificial things, for sure it's that way. But, So, there must be something that tastes just like shrimp and lobster and cheeseburger and everything else. Because Hashem never takes away something unless He gives you something similar. So the Kuzari says the following idea. This is an amazing thing about the Mishnah. If the Cheta Egel was that we needed a physical representation of Hashem, the Mishkan was giving us a sense of that physicality. Number one, the Mishkan was a physical structure. But number two, let's look at the holiest part of the Mishkan, the Makam of the Mishkan where the Shekhinah rested. This was the Kodesh HaKodashim, the Aron HaKodesh. Now in the Aron HaKodesh was the Luchos, both the broken fragments of the first Luchos and the second Luchos. But what's on top of the Aron HaKodesh? You have a gold cover called the Kapores. Don't confuse that with Paroches. Paroches is the curtain between the Mishkan and the Kodesh HaKodashim. That's called Paroches. And this is called Paroches by analogy. But Kapores is a gold cover on top of the Aron HaKodesh. By the gold cover. Remember, the Aron HaKodesh was not standing up like here. The Aron HaKodesh was lying like a box. And what was on top of the Kapores? Two statuettes of angelic figures called the Keruvim. Pretty amazing. In a religion that is so against idolatry, so against looking at images of divinity, in the holiest place on earth, the Mishkan, the Kodesh HaKodashim, and in the Beis HaMikdash, the Kodesh HaKodashim. You actually have something, you have an idol in the Holy of Holies. So the Kuzri says like this, the Kuzri said that if the Jewish people needed physical representations, as sinful as that was, Hashem conceded to their weakness by giving them something that looked like a physical intermediary force. But it remains inaccessible. It remains covered up. Nobody ever sees it. Because only the Kohen Gadol goes in once a year. So we shouldn't get too attached to it. We shouldn't visualize. But we know it's there. So if psychologically we have the insecurity that I can't worship God without something physical, Hashem gives me something physical. So you see the difference between the Sephorno's idea and Rav Yehuda Halevi. The Sephorno looks at the Mishkan as basically telling us, you're no longer deserving of having Hashem everywhere, so I'm going to limit your ability to the Mishkan. It's kind of a punishment. Rav Yehuda Halevi looks at the Mishkan as a compensation for a shortcoming that we had. We had a shortcoming that we needed a physical vehicle of visualization. Hashem gave us this physical vehicle. So these are two different explanations, but the Tzad HaShava Sheman, the common denominator is, they're both going with Rashi's view, that had there not been a Cheta Egel, there would not have been a mission. Now there's a third view explaining Rashi, which is really the simplest, and that is, the Mishkan is simply Hashem's final gift to us, showing that he forgave the golden calf. Meaning to say, just as sometimes if you did something really bad and the person that your parent forgives you, so they'll give you, you know, they have to reassure you that you're still loved, that you haven't been rejected. So had we not sinned, you know, we wouldn't have needed the extra hug. Because of the sin, we needed the hug and the kissing of the Mishkan. It's a sign of divine love and divine forgiveness. So, these are three explanations for Rashi's view that had there not been the sin of the golden calf, there would not have been a Mishkan. Mishkan is only because of Egel, and the Torah is going, Ein Muktim Amuchar B'Torah. That's Rashi. Three reasons. Sephorno, because had there not been a golden calf, we could have worshipped Hashem everywhere. Rav Yehuda Halevi, once we did the golden calf, we have a weakness for physical visualization, and therefore Hashem gives us a way to have that. And the Medrash, as a sign of divine love, he gives us a gift to show his forgiveness of the Chet HaEgel. All of this is in Rashi's opinion that what? That without the Chet HaEgel, there would not have been a Mishnah. Yeah.
Wait, why did Rashi need to say that parts of the Chumash could be out of order?
Yes. Well, the reason Rashi needs to say that is because Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh, which are the commandments of the Mishkan, are actually written before the Golden Calf.
Okay.
So unless the Torah is out of order, you wouldn't be able to say what Rashi says. Okay, now, the counter view, totally different view, is the view of Ramban. Now, Ramban does not disagree with the idea that sometimes the Torah is not in chronological order. You have to say that sometimes. And the Gemara says it. But the Ramban uses the principle only when you absolutely, positively must, because there's no way out. And there are places in the Torah where absolutely something that happened later is written about before. But the Ramban says, unless we are forced to say that something is not chronological, we always assume that events are in chronological order. And therefore, Ramban says, hey, we don't have to change anything. Hashem gave Moshe the commandments of Mishkan in the first 40 days, which is before the Chet HaEgel. But because of the Chet HaEgel and Moshe Rabbeinu's need to pray and go back and forth up in Mount Sinai, he didn't tell them till afterwards. So, in other words, according to Ramban, there would have been a Mishkan no matter what, but the commandment wasn't given to Bnei Yisrael until afterwards because Moshe had to work for the forgiveness of the golden calf. So we have a very, very interesting issue of hypothetically, what would the din have been had there not been a Chet HaEgel? According to Rashi, there would not have been a Mishkan. According to Ramban, there would have been a Mishkan no matter what. But I will tell you one thing, I'll leave the development for next time, I have to stop now. The Meshech Chochma, who goes, which was the Ursa Meir Meshech, the same person, right? So you should feel a special affinity to Rav Meir Simcha Cohen. His sefer on the Rambam is called Ursa Meir, his name is Ari Yeshiva, and his sefer on the Chumash is called the Meshech Chochma. It's the same person, Rav Meir Simcha Cohen. So the Meshech Chochma suggests the following. And again, I'll just throw this out. It won't necessarily make any sense to you at this point. But he says that even like the Ramban, had there not been a sin of the golden calf, the building of the Mishkan would have overridden even Shabbos. You would have been allowed to build the Mishkan even on Shabbos. It was the Chet HaEgel that created the rule that on Shabbos you're not allowed to build the Mishkan. So he says, so like Rashi, the difference is very dramatic. Had there not been a Chet HaEgel, there wouldn't have been a Mishkan. And the Chet HaEgel is why there's a Mishkan. That's Rashi. Ramban says, there would have been a Mishkan even without a Chet HaEgel. And Ramban doesn't say more than that. The Meshech Chochma adds, for reasons I'll discuss next time, that even like Ramban, the Egel made a difference. That prior to the Chet HaEgel, the Mishkan would have been so holy and sanctified that its building would have overridden even the Shabbos. And that which we say, that it does not override Shabbos, that is a consequence of the Chet HaEgel. That's a chiddush of the Meshech Chochma. Next time I'll show you that he has a tremendous diuk in the psukim of how he infers that.
The Meshech Chochma holds that this is not chronological, like Rashi?
No, he holds like the Ramban. He holds it's absolutely chronological. And that's why, except he just makes the point. In other words, there would have been a Mishkan no matter what, because in Truma and Tetzaveh, that was before the Chet HaEgel. But he makes the point in the original command, it even would have happened on Shabbos. Of course, that original command was never carried out because we had the Chet HaEgel, etc. So by the time we got the command from Moshe, it could not be done on Shabbos. Yeah.
Wait, so then he says that there'd be no malachas on Shabbos.
No. I still would use Mishkan to define the malachas that are forbidden.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't apply to the actual building of the Mishkan. In other words, you couldn't do malachas, but you'd be allowed to do the malachas in the actual building of the Mishkan itself. That is just like korbanos, right? Korbanos were brought on Shabbos. So even the building of the Mishkan could have been done on Shabbos, but after the Cheder Egel, we no longer have that. Alrighty, have a good night.